Well, I've already declared an interest in that I've written two historical novels set in the Victorian period, which are now described as neo-Victorian biofictions. And this is not how the first novel was conceived when I began writing it in 1991. What I was wrestling with, the fact I was wrestling with then, was the fact that I was not born a woman, I became one, and I was wondering how to get out of it. So my first novel to address a Victorian life was James Miranda Barry. I began writing that in 91, and it was published in 1999, so I do things slowly. And that was the tale of a Victorian celebrity, the famous colonial doctor, who was rumoured in some quarters to have been, in fact, a woman. But in my own fiction, I presented him as a transgendered gender transgressor. For those of you who are interested in transsexualism, you have gender transgressors and gender defenders, and it's very important to be a gender transgressor, in my view. Well, that novel was not born a neo-Victorian biographical historical fiction. It became one. Now, Sophie and the Sibyl, as has just emerged, is quite self-consciously written as a neo-Victorian novel, in the awareness that this particular genre has a literary history and an associated developing body of literary criticism. And I confess straight away, I'm on the board of neo-Victorian studies, so, you know, I'm got my finger in almost every pie. And I wrote that novel in the awareness of the issues that have been coming up in this conference and that we've been discussing, so it's great. But it does also have that very personal level, which George picked up about affect, in that I was actually trying to settle my scores with the Victorian novelist I most admire, cherish, reread, and adore, and that, of course, is Marianne Evans Lewis. Better known, but during her life in this world, never addressed or described except in letters, as George Eliot. So throughout Sophie and the Sibyl, I gave her all her names, Mrs. Lewis, Marianne, Polly, or the Sibyl, and all those names died with her. It's only after her death in 1880 that she sheds them all, and is named the writer we remember as George Eliot. And this is very interesting with the Brontes, because nobody except us, when we're making a point, refer to them as Currer, Ellis, and Acton Bell. They've all taken their real names. George Eliot has gone for her pseudonym. In fact, it's something to do with being called George, I think, because we don't talk about George Sand except as George Sand. And I've never referred to George Egerton as anything other than George Egerton. So there we go. So maybe it's to do with being George. George, take note. Anyway, George Eliot, my intention in that book was that to represent George Eliot, both the woman and the writer, because I think there's a huge gap between the two that's immediately perceived, which is there in a lot of Victorian women writers. It's there in Charlotte Bronte. I think one of the things that people who write about Charlotte Bronte need to address is the dutiful Christian woman, violently anti-papist, and this wild erotic writer, because there's a huge gulf which does need to be addressed. But for me, George Eliot was my heroine in this fiction and my celebrity novelist. Now, I'd often wondered what linked those two life stories, James Miranda Barry and George Eliot. And to me, it's clearly two things. Neither character chooses the life he or she might have had as ordinary women, and both of them adopted male identities. Barry may not have been a woman at all, and George Eliot was famous for being both hideous and very, very clever. She educated herself well beyond the level needed to be a wife and mother. So that for me, James Miranda Barry and Marianne Evans Lewis both took the risks of the road not taken. They became celebrities by being, thinking, and living outside the norms of Victorian lives. And they're often discussed as oddballs, scandals, or freaks. Now, new Victorian writers are fascinated by freaks, both the people who worked as freaks and the people who were considered to be freaks. And here I'm thinking of Carol Birch's novel, Orphans of the Carnival, 2016, which reimagines the life of Julia Pastrana, or the Ape Woman. I was, unfortunately, I had to review that novel, which I did not like at all. And I don't like writing very hostile reviews. If I was going to write a very hostile review, I would actually ask someone else to do it. I don't think there's any point in taking up the page being horrible. So I wrote a very measured review, but I hated it. And the numerous versions of Joseph Merrick, who's also known as the Elephant Man. He has a fantastic array of books about him. Any scholar involved in disability studies has a wealth of material to discuss. Even numerous neo-Victorian lesbian narratives describe the lesbian as a perceived freak. I watched some of the BBC HBO 2019 version of The Life of Anne Lister, which represents her as Gentleman Jack, the lesbian who is a freak but gets away with it and gets away with being a freak. Actually, I can talk for hours about Anne Lister because I think Helena Whitbread made it all up. I think it's a fake. It's too good to be true. So the neo-Victorian obsession with freaks isn't strange. The best fiction, I'm going to make a general point about all fiction now because this is what I think. The best fiction deals with or extraordinary people in ordinary situations or ordinary people in extraordinary situations, and historical fiction writers have always been drawn to extraordinary people in extraordinary situations. And in my view, you write about ordinary people in ordinary situations at your peril. This is the domain of reality TV, and it's very hard to make those narratives interesting. I will never find them interesting. But both biographers and historians are given to speculation. Oh, wait a minute, I've missed a bit. I'm talking about biography and history. Yeah. This is the question. What then is the point of writing a biographical historical fiction? Why would a novelist want her imagination limited by inconvenient biographical facts? Now, I'm not using any shortcuts in the descriptive terminology, biographical, historical, fictional, because none of these words sit comfortably together. A biography is not a novel, and history is not fiction. Well, not officially. But if you read a lot of ancient history, which I do, you'll find that both biographers and historians are given to speculation and even to reproducing imaginary dialogue. My favourite at the moment ancient historian is Josephus, and he often wrote out great men's great speeches, so does Thucydides. But this practice ended with the professionalisation of the discipline of history in the 19th century. But I think we all recognise the troubled waters where these three streams, biography, history, fiction, meet and overlap. And some of us think they shouldn't do. I'm going to suggest that perhaps rather than thinking in terms of rules and conventions, we could investigate the question by thinking about the reader's expectations. What does the reader expect from a biography? A biographer has a duty to abide by the known and proven facts of the life of her chosen subject and to situate that subject in the appropriate historical context. A novelist's primary duty is to the reader and to the form of the novel that the writer has chosen to use. All biographers, historians, novelists, however, select their material. But they often do it differently and for different reasons. A biographer should address, indeed often relishes, inconvenient facts or contradictory evidence. Fiction can, and often does, distort or discard the facts and the evidence, delighting some readers and infuriating others. You're always going to get the reader who spends a lot of time on Google. Just have to get used to it as a novelist. They then send you an email. Sometimes they send you a drawing. It's extraordinary. Both history and biography attempt to provide plausible explanations to fill up the gaps left in the documentary record. But a novelist, and this I think came out in the earlier discussions of Charlotte Bronte, of the Brontes, a novelist exploits and enjoys the inevitable hiatus that is left by time. And as novelists, we don't necessarily have to be plausible. All biographers speculate, and these speculations are often their most contentious pieces of interpretation, whereas a novelist is expected to imagine, suggest, and invent. And it is, in my view, not a freedom that we should abandon. But all three kinds of writing, biography, history, fiction, exploit the what-if elements of possibility. The radical difference between these forms and registers of writing is located in the reader, her demands and her expectations. We don't read history and fiction in the same way or for the same reasons. Can we learn anything significant about a writer's work from her life or the story of her life? Yes, sometimes. Can we learn anything important about her from her work? Yes, but again, only sometimes. We can make certain deductions about how she thinks. And while we can speculate, we cannot know. The past sometimes proves to be a locked door. One of the things I think that comes up with us as 19th century researchers is that there's a lot of documentation of the Victorian period so that you feel you can sort of get your handle on it. No, you can't. You can never know enough. You just can't. You can't be there. You don't know what it's like. I find that, you know, feeling that we can go back into the past and have some authority over the past is madness. You can't. I want to pick up a question of ethics. This isn't what Rosario was talking about the ethics of care, but there's a deep concern in the academic commentary on biographical fictional writing about ethics and about what it is ethical to do. And I have to admit that I find this puzzling, because in British law, you cannot libel the dead, although you can, and very often you do, upset their descendants. But what I think is in play here is the emotional investment many readers have in the writers they admire, which comes back a bit to the fan fictions. Because I was very interested in what Lucy was saying about fan fictions, because there are some writers, George R.R. Martin, if you're keen on Game of Thrones, he has banned all fan fiction and he will pursue you with waiving his copyright if you try and write anything about his characters. And his line is, my characters are mine, I own them, I get to kill them, you don't. Which I think is quite interesting. It also links up with, as some people ban slash fiction, if any of you are keen on that, you know, queer sex. You imagine Frodo having it off with Sam. I won't go there. Okay. I think this emotional investment that we have talked about in this session, about the emotional investment that readers have in the writers they admire, if we are serious readers, we are fans. We're fans of the fictions we love. We're fans of the characters we love. And we may want to write fan fictions in return. And some of those fan fictions might be explosive and revelatory, or they may amount to the whitewashing of the writers we admire. Now, my view of this is that whitewashing makes for ludicrous stories and obsequious, ingratiating prose. I should say that whitewashing is a technical term used by publishers, British publishers, when they spot an author losing his or her nerve and softening the edges of an unpleasant character. I think we need to fall in love with villains again. Go on, you know you love them. Count Fosco, Mrs. LeCount. Oh, Fagin, Sykes, you know, it's the villains. I mean, Estella's a villain, isn't she? Dickens has the most fantastic villains. And I do notice that in a lot of neo-Victorian writing, a fear of the villain. The villain should not fill us with anything but fascination. I mean, can you imagine Othello arrives on Cyprus, vanquishes the Turks, retrieves Desdemona, and all goes well? That's it. You need Iago. Well, now, what I'm going to say next is tricky, because this is about political correctness. If we love the work of a writer whose politics, personal behaviour and character can shown to be alarming, disgusting or dangerous, if she or he is racist, anti-Semitic, misogynist, a child molester, an advocate of selective murder, should we continue to admire the prose? Now, this is a vexed and complex intellectual terrain in which the reader's invested emotions tend to erupt and overflow. And it is my view that we should not, indeed cannot, confuse the teller with the tale. I too, in my time, have occupied the moral high ground of feminist condemnation. I think I spent about 10 years camped out on the moral high ground, simply because I do not enjoy reading writing which calls for me, as a woman, to be exploited, underpaid, despised, raped, bullied, or killed. A secondary element in the mulch of neo-Victorian prose and its critical commentators is thus this demand for political correctness. And it's a demand that usually undermines the fan fictions. We did vaguely hear it, actually, in something I think it was Isabel read this morning. There's a school of academic literary criticism which argues that neo-Victorian fiction should be engaged in righting the wrongs of the past rather than in digging for bestseller scandals. Neo-Victorian writers should, therefore, employ narrative strategies which valorise the marginal, the discredited, the outcast. We should lend our voices to the voiceless, the invisible, the people who have been silenced. If you have been trampled by history, colonial or otherwise, you should be able to find your champion who will be your advocate and tell your story. Is one of the purposes of the neo-Victorian project in all its forms to do justice to the ignored, marginal subjects who were victims of oppression? Of course they can be brought back, given a voice, resurrected and celebrated. These certainly are things that liberal-minded writers can do. But why should they be obliged to do so? And why should literary agendas be prescribed as necessary critical medicine by academic critics? My point here is very simple. It is that I'm not making any great claims for neo-Victorian writing, but I am making now great claims for great art. Some great art is spectacularly distressing and offensive in political terms. I find works such as Vladimir Nabokov's classic, Lolita, unreadable. But the book's status is not in question, not in my head, and I hope in no one else's. In fact, there's been a rewrite of it this year by a French writer, the Journal de Elle, which tells the story again from Lolita's point of view. Some people cannot, in all conscience, listen to anything composed by Wagner. J.M. Coetzee's Booker Prize-winning novel Disgrace, which is unrepentantly both racist and misogynist, nevertheless, in my view, deserved the prize. And of course we have the right to engage in nuanced argument. I denounced Coetzee at some length in my own book on contemporary fiction, Writing on the Wall. But I never denied the quality and power of his prose on the grounds that what he actually had to say was unacceptable to me. Because the power of his prose was precisely the element that made his work so persuasive and so dangerous. Now, I quite understand that conscientious historians working within a discipline based on evidence might well feel they need to adhere to an ethical professional structure. similar to the one outlined by Hilary Mantel. Now, this is what Mantel says in reply to a query put to her by a neo-Victorian biofiction writer, Miranda Miller. If you want to read this essay, it's in the latest, I think it's all there, it's in the latest edition of Neo-Victorian Studies, which is about to or has just gone live. Miranda Miller asked her about the writer's duty to the biographical fictional subject, and Mantel, of course, is famous for not changing a word of history. And this is what she says. I think you owe them the same respect a biographer shows or a historian. So there's the lineup. If you want to be a good fiction writer, line up with the biographers and historians. So you put the work in. That's the main thing. You should only make guesses on the basis of the best evidence you can get. But you must beware of the corrupting power of empathy and keep going back to the evidence. I suppose my own method is imagine grudgingly, imagine sparingly, but imagine thoroughly. Now, I'm a great admirer of Mantel's Tudor historical fictions. In fact, I found them a revelation. I was reading as little as I could of her as possible because I found it so appalling until I read Wolf Hall. And then I thought, what has happened to her? And I actually have a theory about what has happened to her, which is to do with Cromwell. Cromwell was a lawyer. Hilary Mantel is a lawyer. And suddenly, that way of thinking, as she occupies his head, it all clicked. She wants to write with the same authority as a biographer and a historian. And I think that word authority, she has a very conventional view of what authority means. But in my view, it's not necessarily how you tell good stories or how you write good fiction. Katie Royfe, in the afterword to her suggestive and beautifully written book on the relationship between Lewis Carroll and Alice Liddell, Still She Haunts Me, unapologetically states, I have altered geography, chronology, and history where it served the purposes of the novel. So here, fiction trumps biography and history. Royfe runs up her flag. Fiction should be at the service of the reader and the story. The word resurrection has come up in our discussions already many times, and I'm going to resurrect resurrection yet again. Because it seems to me that historical biographical novelists are resurrection men. And I use the gender advisedly because I am referring to Burke and Hare, the resurrection men. We unearth the bodies that are lost and reanimate them in our fictions. And this, of course, comes back to the Brontes big time, because if you think about Wuthering Heights, when we were listening to Nellie Dean this morning, I thought, yeah, you know, Nellie Dean is sitting there in the kitchen talking while everybody else is digging up the corpse of their lost beloved. So the resurrection can become really quite literal. Conjure up the thinking, breathing body. This is, I think, what fiction can do. The voice, the glance, the physical presence of the person the reader desires to meet. That's what fiction can do in extraordinary ways. Problems immediately surface. How do we read that lost body in order to reanimate and reinterpret its desires and decisions? In the case of My James Miranda Barry, the body itself is the site of speculation and dispute. And of course it does matter, because when Barry trained to be a doctor in Edinburgh in 1810, women could not train to be doctors. But whoever or whatever he was, Barry chose independence, freedom, adventure, and he got away with it. In the case of George Eliot, I have a slightly different question, which has far-reaching implications for the kind of biographical fiction you can write. How does a writer represent a writer if you think, as I do, that the most important thing about him or her is their writing and the quality of their work? Endless scenes of a writer sitting at her table make for very, very boring fiction. You don't want to reproduce the writing, she's already written it. So what literary biographies, writers' lives, therefore tend to do, is to concentrate on the apparent sources of the subject's writing, and these will always be much the same. Childhood, homes, families, traumas, loss, landscapes, mentors, teachers, or in the case of George Eliot, religious fights and hopeless crushes on older men. But I'll pursue another line of inquiry that tends to surface in neo-Victorian fiction. And this is where I run up my flag of ethics. Does the art of the writer justify the sacrifices, sometimes the waste of whole lives that have been laid at its feet? And I should say that these are the only ethical issues which keep me awake at night. Who paid the price, and was it worth it? And I want to turn, for the last part, to two concrete examples, both published at the beginning of the 21st century, before the neo-Victorian critical boom really got going. If you start the boom with Christian Gutleben's Nostalgic Postmodernism, then these both come out around the same time. Both novels are biographical fictions written in completely different registers, and the writers represented are Henry James and Lewis Carroll. Colm Toybean's classic work of biographical fiction, The Master, 2004, is a portrait of Henry James. The novel was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. I think it should have won. It was when Alan Hollinghurst won instead, and won numerous awards. It won the Impact Award that year. Toybean begins not with James's celebrity, but with his spectacular moment of total failure, which is the disastrous first night of his play Guy Domville in 1895. Interestingly, Lodge in Author starts with this at the same place. Lodge, I'm happy to say, had a deep trauma about the fact that everybody seemed to be writing about Henry James. Yeah, the trick is to be the person who writes the best book, and as far as I'm concerned, it was Toybean. I've read them all, and it's Toybean, not just by a head, but by about 80 lengths. By choosing to portray James at the moment of his discouragement and failure, and just before the last great period of his writing life, Toybean builds in a strange homage to James into the fiction. James is about to write The Spoils of Poynton, What Maisie Knew, both in 1897, The Turn of the Screw, 1898, The Awkward Age, 1899, The Wings of the Dove, 1902, The Ambassadors, 1903, I love The Ambassadors, The Golden Bull, 1904. James possessed a courage and persistence that was about to turn failure into triumph and lead into gold. Toybean's portrait of a writer makes the conditions necessary for writing central to the narrative. These conditions will be different for each writer. James's strategies of presence and absence, his refusal to commit himself to anything or anyone, all involve putting himself first. His house at Rye becomes a lair from which he emerges to, and I quote James, observe, observe perpetually. James embodies the writer as spy. Now, this novel is not only a psychological portrait of a writer famous for his irony, his ambiguity, and his evasiveness, but it's also an analysis of the loneliness of a homosexual man incarcerated in the closet. This is a novel about the way the writer sees the world, not how the world sees him. So Toybean follows James's point of view, but doesn't use first-person narrative. I mean, I'll come out close again now with another interest. I actually loathe first-person narrative. Oh, God, it's so boring. And the other thing about the first-person narrative is that young writers who say, oh, I feel it'll get me closer to the reader. It will. I said, have you ever been trapped in the pub where you can't get out and the bore is sitting right next to you and telling you about everywhere that he's been and everything that he's done? Quite often, first-person narrators are very, very boring. So I think Toybean does what Hilary Mantel does in her Cromwell books. She stays very close to Cromwell's point of view, but still keeps that wise critical distance. And Toybeen does the same thing. He's very close to Henry James's point of view, so that you're seeing the world from his through his eyes. The Oscar Wilde trial is one of the central public events described at the beginning of the novel, and there's a gripping exchange with the writer and critic Edmund Gosse, whose work I adore. He appears to have been another closet case. I've read some of the letters. Goodness. Gosse implies that James might have been carrying on with rent boys like Oscar Wilde and was therefore at risk of the accusation, which appears in E.M. Forster's Morris, that he is an unspeakable of the Oscar Wilde sort. This used to be a great joke in my department in Manchester. Are you an unspeakable of the Oscar Wilde sort? Oh dear, yes. I shouldn't have said that to the head of admissions. He is. And yet, moving and gripping as this novel is, I think, and this is where I'm going to be contentious, it's a very sympathetic whitewash of a life of anxieties and paranoias that could be read quite differently. James was a man full of silences and secrets. Now, secrets, as you all know, are the lifeblood of Victorian fiction. Of all fiction, but particularly Victorian fiction. So to return to my earlier question, and this is the question I asked of Toybeen's book, who gets sacrificed to the art of Henry James? Well, she was another writer, and her name is Constance Fenimore Woolson. Now, all I ever knew about Constance before I began to unearth her life and work from beneath the grim shadow of Henry James was that she was a successful and innovative American writer, devoted to James and his most astute reader. She is also reputed to be the inspiration for his famous heroine, Isabel Archer. And it's said that she killed herself when James let her down by refusing to spend the winter near her in Venice. She's sometimes portrayed as the ultimate fag hag, devoted but deluded. The really extraordinary story is what happened to her dresses when she was dead. It fell to James to dispose of them, and he rowed out to the centre of the lagoon in Venice, aided by her gondolier, and tried to drown the dresses. Unfortunately, the vast skirts returned, these wonderful Victorian skirts, they returned to the surface as black, soaking balloons. The body that had once inhabited them is gone. The clothes remain as an appalling reminder of a physical presence that James had already repudiated. I went back to look at the original reception to Toybeen's novel, and I found a review in The Guardian by the biographer Hermione Lee. And she too rehearses the story I've just told you, so that Constance is being constantly reinscribed as this pathetic hanger-on who unfortunately wasn't drowned with her dresses. She also insists, this is Hermione Lee when she rehearses the story, she also insists on the supremacy of the biographical agenda in neo-Victorian fiction. She says, how the books grew out of the life is the novel's deepest story. Now, Toybeen is too reverent towards the facts of James's life to tinker with the selective trajectory he's chosen to dramatise, but he does give Constance Fenimore Woolson a body, a voice, and a subversive talent for caustic observations. While she was staying at Bella Sguardo above Florence, where she befriended Francis Bott, or Boot, and his daughter Lizzie, Constance notices that the rooms in their household were exact duplicates of Gilbert Osmond's delicate arrangements in The Portrait of a Lady. He copied the rooms. And this is her reaction in Toybeen's novel. Sometimes, she said, when the father and daughter spoke, it was as though Gilbert Osmond and his daughter Pansy were having a conversation. You have introduced me to two of the characters from your books, she wrote, and I am grateful to you. But I wonder if you have plans to include me in the sequel. James, in Toybean's portrait, allows his irritation at this point to show, and he clearly suggests that the discussion of sources for his novels must remain in the realm of the unspoken, like the Rent Boys. So Henry James liked to listen and observe, but he did not like being observed too closely by another's eyes. Now, most rational people who do not live in the public eye or seek celebrity of any kind will, upon finding themselves portrayed in other people's novels, this is living people, be angry, outraged, insulted, and they will ring up their lawyers. This, they will view the fact, if it can be proved, as a form of identity theft. The recreation of a living person is, and I think this is true, is rightly perceived to be an uncanny intrusion upon another's privacy, even as a form of witchcraft, an eerie stealing of faces, voices, bodies. And I think this is because you are being interpreted, overwritten, and remade. And it's a common reaction to all three streams of writing that I drew together earlier on in my talk: history, biography, fiction. I mean, there's still dreadful fights when anyone does a new biography of Winston Churchill. The electric tension between human being, the material past, and the documented interpretation can never be avoided, and it can never be suppressed. Now, in Toybean's novel, Constance's family trust James to go through her papers and manuscripts. And what does James do? He sets about burning every bit of paper that links his life to hers. His relationship with a woman who was his intellectual equal reveals James to be a monster of egotism and selfishness, who envied his supposed great friend her commercial success. James has form on this. When he was right at the end of his life, he was very pissed off with Arnold Bennett and H.G. Wells, whom he said were chin-deep in trophies. So I immediately want to send him a text or something and say, listen, I'm not teaching Wells and Bennett this year, I'm teaching you. You know, get over it. But James and Woolson, this is a really complex issue because he denies her at every turn, even to his friends. And as she says at one point bitterly in the novel, being partly invisible is a small part of my charm. How many women can say that? Being partly invisible is a small part of my charm. But my hostile interpretation is not the obvious reading of James's character and motives. Toybean saturates James in what appears to be excessive and unnecessary feelings of guilt at Constance's death. He lets James off the hook, and it takes another woman writer, Anne Boyd Rue, in her biography of Constance Fenimore Woolson, to reclaim Constance's life and writing from beneath the larger shadow cast over them by Henry James. I've read this biography, I think it's brilliant, and it came out in 2016, and she very boldly entitles it Portrait of a Novelist, Portrait of a Lady Novelist, which is great, isn't it? Portrait of a Lady Novelist. It really is the finger of James. And she dedicates the book to members of the Constance Fenimore Woolson Society. So do you see what's happened here? Toybean and James have trampled on Constance, but the writer James discarded has found her champion, the biographer to the rescue. I'm aware that I'm coming up. I've got 3 minutes. Right. I've got actually quite a lot, so I'll just pull this just pull it together really with the Alice question, because I don't think I need to say too much about Alice and Carol, because we're going to talk about them a little later this afternoon. But I would like to say one thing that Toybean also elides, which is this suggestive and unsettling question of James's interest in children. James wrote the most terrifying tale of child sexual abuse, which is The Turn of the Screw. And it's wonderfully concealed inside a fashionable horror story of a haunted house. Now, there are many, as you know, Victorian writers, painters, photographers, even art critics, whose interest in children is a symphony of sinister perversion. Now, the alleged guilty parties who fascinate me most, there are three of them, Henry James, J.M. Barrie, the writer who created Peter Pan, and Lewis Carroll. Their fascination with children is either overtly sexual or salacious enough to make a modern reader uneasy, perhaps even scandalised. And crucially, they will not allow their child characters to grow up or to grow old. Which brings me back to Katie Royfe's novel, Still She Haunts Me, published in 2001, which is the story of Charles Dodgson, Lewis Carroll, Alice Little. Now, I'm going to end with this, really, because this seems to me to be pull the point together, which is that Royfe raises some of the central problems which bedevil neo-Victorian biographical fiction and the representation of the writer. The first problem is that great sin, which hasn't come up yet, presentism. Are you all guilty? Presentism is, of course, the uncritical adherence to present-day attitudes, especially the tendency to interpret past events in terms of modern values and concepts. I had a double feeling when I sort of started researching presentism, because I'd only ever heard historians use it, and they used it of each other as an insult. You're guilty of presentism there, aren't you? You know, if you sit in you sit there in the seminar and suddenly someone is accused of presentism and everybody else goes, you know, presentism. Take him out and string him out. I thought, well, presentism won't be a useful tool in interpreting or imagining the past and past lives. But then I thought, actually, it's unavoidable. So I read a whole theoretical debate in Past and Present on presentism, and I found myself in agreement with the medieval historian Miri Rubin. She's written a great book on the Virgin Mary. If you're keen on the Virgin Mary, she's your woman. And she notes in her article, Presentism's Useful Anachronisms, that the term is generally applied to historians who acknowledge the impact of ethical considerations on their work, and who use conceptual frames like feminism, guilty, Marxism, also a bit guilty, post-colonialism, very guilty. The presentist is thus accused of being a confuser of categories, an offender whose crime is the historian's cardinal sin, anachronism. In defence, she argues that historians, and I'd include writers of historical or neo-Victorian fiction, are unavoidably presentist and should be so consciously, since it's only through the engaged use of concepts and the posing of ethical questions that history or historical fiction does justice to the past and is accountable to the present. Last point on Royfe. I just loved this book. I picked it up, I can't remember quite how I did it. I think Royfe took part in a Me Too movement debate where she ruffled everybody's feathers. And apparently this book ruffled people as well. So I thought, oh, right, I'll read it. All historical fiction, it seems, is in danger of patronising the past. And it seems to me that the Lewis Carroll-Alice Little relationship is especially fraught, and we can talk about this later this afternoon, because we lack a sensibility that could ever regard that relationship as innocent. So most contemporary readers, myself included, considering that famous golden afternoon where grown men entertain little girls on a riverbank near Oxford and tell them stories of rabbit holes, talking caterpillars, drugs that change your body shape, red queens devoted to beheadings, we would all assume we were looking at a crime scene. Now, Royfe uses the characters' real names, and she researched Dodgson's life carefully. But she puts biographical fact at the service of her plot and her fictional strategies. I think I'll stop there. Okay. I wonder if I could show you the pictures. I don't know whether I'm going to... Can you give us a hand on that? I'm not sure whether I'm going to be able to do it. If we can... How do I do it? Listen, this is just a sort of to make you feel sick as parrots before you go out to your lunch. Royfie, yeah, there's Alice. Right, what Royfie does, yeah, is she uses as the turning point in the novel the photographs. She reads the photographs. Now, the photographs aren't reproduced in the novel, they're just evoked. And they're evoked in very interesting ways. And I thought, well, I mean, they must be online, mustn't they? So I went and looked. And then I thought, I'll send these to Armel because I don't want them on my computer anymore. One of the things that Royfie works with is the look. She looks at Alice and puts us in the position of being Carol. So that's the first one. Remember, Carol was friends with Alice from when she was 5 to when she was 11. And then something went horribly wrong in the last days of June in 1863. Alice, watch the look. I mean, I just want Angela Carter in this room because she'll say, there, you see Patricia? She wants it, they all do. Look at the look. Alice, thank God, is not looking at him there. Those are all three girls, the sisters, and Alice is the one looking at him, giving him the look. Mind you, I think Edith is giving him a bit of the look. It's Lorena in the middle, Edith on the left, Alice on the right. There are the three sisters again. Alice on the right this time. There is Alice and Lorena. Look at the look, dressed up as Chinamen. It's part of this Victorian portrait photography where you dressed up as a sailor. I've got pictures of my father dressed up as a little sailor boy, just like these pictures. And he looked absolutely gorgeous. He looked like Alice. There's the famous one of the little beggar girl, the déshabillé one. And there's Alice kissing Carol. Now, that picture was taken by Julia Margaret Cameron. And Julia Margaret Cameron, if you think about some of her pictures, I don't know if you know Love Locked Out, which is basically sort of little children start naked. Now, here's the real porn show. This are the Hatch sisters. This is Beatrice Hatch. And the next one is Evelyn Hatch. Now, the thing about these, of course, is that they are photoshopped, aren't they? Mm-hmm. He painted them. But, I mean, he used somebody's child to get the body right. Mm-hmm. And he did here as well. Mm-hmm. That's Beatrice, I think, not Evelyn. I found the photographs. I mean, these are just some that I looked at. I found tons of them. All you have to do is just put Lewis Carroll Alice into the Google and enough of it will come up. And Royfie makes use of these photographs in the denouement of her novel, I think, in really very clever ways. You don't have to have seen the photographs to get it. Okay, I'll stop.
Thank you. Thank you very much.